thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Military prosecutors charged the alleged Fort Hood shooter, Nadil Malik Hassan, with 13 counts of premeditated murder and intend to seek the death penalty. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he plans to bring a health care bill to the floor of the Senate next week. And President Obama announces a White House jobs summit in December. Joining me in the studio for this week's Friday News Roundup, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And joining us for the first time on the News Roundup, Ross Douthat of The New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. We'll take calls in just a bit. Or you can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, the Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to announce within the hour that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-admitted mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, will be tried in New York City in a civilian court. Karen, tell us about this decision.
Well, this decision is coming up against a deadline for the administration to begin figuring out what they're going to do with the various detainees in Guantanamo. And it is, I think there are going to be a lot of really interesting issues raised. Some of which, in fact, are going to stem from the methods that were used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was waterboarded, I think, 183 times. And so as they go forward, they're going to have, somebody who is admitted to playing the central role in this. But the other evidence that is brought out is going to be very much, I think, held up to scrutiny because of this.
Is this a surprise, Russ?
Not really. I mean, I think we've heard from the beginning that the Obama administration has a preference to try figures like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in civilian courts as opposed to trying to use the military commission system. I think there are going to be real interesting political consequences to this.
What kind of political consequences?
Well, I think, a lot depends obviously on how the trial goes and how some of the issues that Karen raised play out. But you've already seen a reaction, I think, just this morning from conservatives that, this is an example of returning to a kind of pre-9/11 mindset where terrorism is strictly a law enforcement problem. And you're giving figures like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed the protections of a civilian court if the prosecution runs into trouble, if something goes wrong in the prosecution. I think you can imagine conservatives trying to create a political backlash against the Obama administration's handling of it.
I guess you could wonder, what if he's acquitted? What if the evidence is thrown out because of waterboarding and torture and they fail to get a conviction? Is that conceivable, Ruth?
I actually find it inconceivable because clearly the folks at the Justice Department went through the calculation of what is our evidence? What is our chance of keeping this evidence admissible? And the last thing on earth that they would risk is the possibility of an acquittal for various reasons, among them the political consequences of an acquittal. My understanding, and I could be wrong here, is that while he was waterboarded 183 times and while one could easily imagine that a judge would exclude that evidence, that there are confessions that he gave pre-waterboarding that would not be excludable, that would be admitted. And they have not only that evidence against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but there's a pre-existing, if I could use a healthcare word, there's a pre-existing indictment. I just did that for Karen. There's a pre-existing indictment against him in the Southern District of New York. So I think that the notion of kind of conservative criticism of the Obama administration for going back to the pre-9/11 mindset is just really misplaced. I think it's, as a practical matter, it's preferable to, bottom line, it's preferable to convict people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and to convict them with the most exquisite process you can imagine, a lot of due process, so that nobody can question it.
We expect the Attorney General's announcement at 11 o'clock. We're talking based on source stories that are out this morning about what he'll announce. These stories say that he will announce a military tribunal connected to the bombing of the USS Cole, Karen, and so they're not going totally to the civilian route.
That's right. And I don't understand, you know, what the differences are between the two cases. But, you know, the president early on had signaled that he did want to move away from the use of the military tribunal system, which had been set up under President Bush.
Now, we know that when there's been talk about moving Guantanamo detainees to U.S. soil, some communities have been very concerned about having them in the neighborhood. What do you think, Ross, the attitude of New Yorkers will be
towards having Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried
in New York City?
I think trials will prompt a very different reaction from the prospects of long-term detention. I think any criticism that this produces will have to do with the form of the trial and the question of whether you want these people prosecuted militarily and whether it makes sense to make these distinctions that we're not exactly clear on why they're making between different terror attacks producing different kind of trials. But as to the trial itself happening in New York, I think the overwhelming reaction from New Yorkers will be positive. I think there'll be a strong, you know, just as states compete to see who got to try, you know, the Mid-Atlantic sniper, I think there's kind of a sense of, you know, we want to get this guy.
Oh, and there was a very big competition, but between and among U.S. attorney's offices, and at least according to one of the initial reports that I read, they've sort of split the difference a little bit, that the New York, it will be tried in New York, but there's going to be a Virginia team along with them, because serious prosecutors like nothing better than to, you know, grab hold of a big case like this.
Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, has made the point in the past that New York is in some ways accustomed to having terror trials. They've had them in the past. They've gone well. And so perhaps some of those concerns in some communities, perhaps we won't see that in New York City. Now, the timing of this is interesting, Karen Tumulty, in that Greg Craig, the top White House attorney who was early in the administration in charge of trying to figure out how to deal with Guantanamo Bay and Obama's promise to close it, his resignation was announced this morning. Do we think there's any connection?
Well, I don't know if it's actually been announced, but
it was announced.
That's interesting because he had been criticized for his handling of it, and specifically what Greg Craig had been criticized for was not anticipating the political backlash from members of Congress who would basically be arguing, you know, not in my district are you going to be housing these guys. And it turned into, you know, what the administration thought was going to be a great, you know, political coup for them, turning into essentially a disaster. And the blame for that fell, fairly or not, on Greg Craig's shoulders. It's interesting because he is a very prominent Washington attorney, came to fame as the Clinton's attorney during impeachment, and had, interestingly enough, been a very important ally for Barack Obama during his presidential campaign when he broke with the Clintons.
You know, we have had rumors about Greg Craig resigning for months, denied over and over again by the White House. Does it cost the White House anything when they deny and deny and deny and then they announce?
Oh, what a surprise that the White House would do that. I mean, I think that to think about the relationship between the announcement of his resignation this morning and the announcement of this quote-unquote solution to at least some of the detainee problem. Look, I think he was given an intractable problem of what to do about these detainees. He is not, as some White House counsels have been in the past to their detriment, a political neophyte. He's the opposite of naive, and he was just handed this problem and then blamed in some sense for the difficulty that anybody would have encountered in resolving it. I do think that it's possible that the White House might have hoped that the announcement of the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed prosecution might to some extent overwhelm the announcement of his resignation and his replacement by Bob Bauer.
And it is a Friday, which, of course, is a traditional day to announce news. You don't want to get a lot of attention. He'll be replaced by Bob Bauer, who is a well-known Democratic attorney and the husband of Anita Dunn, who's been the communications director at the White House, but is about to leave that job. Well, Ross, bring us up to date on what's happening in the investigation in Fort Hood into that terrible shooting.
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting thing that's happened in that investigation isn't actually related to the killer himself. It's what's happened with the way I believe the military initially described the shooting of the killer and touted, and her name is escaping me, and maybe one of my fellow panelists can help me here. The local policewoman who was initially hailed as the heroine of the story for shooting Major Hassan, and then over the last couple days, a new story has come out, and there have been sort of contradictory reports. But apparently, she was shot, and then one of her fellow policemen was the one who actually took him down. And I think it's fascinating, and it's because in certain ways it parallels the way the military handled the Jessica Lynch case in Iraq, where there was sort of an initial burst of sort of publicity presenting her as a sort of military heroine, not just a victim in this situation. And there's sort of a weird dynamic going on that I frankly don't understand myself, where you have a situation where the military has an official policy against women in combat, and yet there seems to be this deep desire on the part of people, perhaps just in the publicity arm of the U.S. military, every time they have a kind of, you know, Joan of Arc figure in a way to sort of overtout
Joan
her
of Arc armed,
right? Yeah, to overtout her achievement. So that I think that's the development that I've been following with the most interest.
Although I do think the questions that are going to linger that have been raised this week were the ones of why did so many different agencies miss the signals on this guy?
We're going to talk more about that after we take a short break. And when we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane has been on a cruise with public radio listeners. I'm joined in the studio for the first hour of our news roundup by Ruth Marcus. She's a columnist and editorial writer with The Washington Post. And Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. And Ross Douthat. He's a columnist with The New York Times. Well, Karen, tell us about some of the things that you're watching as we look at the news developments with the Fort Hood investigation.
Well, it is now becoming increasingly clear that the suspect's behavior was absolutely bizarre, that he was proselytizing and talking about jihad during grand rounds so the idea that the military would see somebody who was obviously this troubled and put him in a position of counseling people who were in a very fragile state coming back from war is just mind-boggling. On top of that, we've had a number of revelations that he was having contacts with figures overseas, emails. These were things that the government knew about him before any of this happened at Fort Hood. So you've got to wonder, was this a lack of coordination among various intelligence and security agencies? Was this, certainly questions have been raised about whether the signals were missed because of signs that, you know, political correctness and people didn't want to come down on him because he was a Muslim. These, I think, are things that we are all going to be spending the next few months and even longer than that looking at.
Ruth? And I think from what we know now, and obviously, as Ross was pointing out, the facts are changing and evolving, and and also still coming out. But from the way I see it now, I'm more troubled by the Army's failure to deal with the clear problems that he was having than I am by the FBI/intelligence agency's failure to connect the dots from the imam in Yemen who he was having emails with. Those emails might have been understandable research. There may be restrictions that they have in terms of communicating that to the Army. That's not yet clear to me. But the notion that people in the military could have been having discussions about whether their own psychiatrist was psychotic or not and solved the problem by essentially kicking them to a different place. And I think as part of that, actually promoting him is really outrageous.
You know, Ross, Senator Joe Lieberman has said he's going to ask for hearings. He calls Hassan a homegrown terrorist. Do you think this was an act of terror?
Well, sure. It doesn't mean that it was. I think it should be possible to call something an act of terror without conjuring up the images of 9/11. I think we talked about it earlier, but I think it would be fair to call the D.C. Maryland Mid-Atlantic sniper an act of, you know, his work an act of terror. I think the good news in this case is that it's a reminder, in a sense, of who our enemies tend to be, and who are the kind of people who turn into homegrown terrorists. You can imagine, as horrible as Major Hassan's crimes were, you could imagine an alternative reality in which he were a more serious figure, a more serious plotter, and given his position and the fact that the military was obviously terrified, and I do think it was for reasons of political correctness to really do anything about him, you could imagine this being a whole lot worse. So that's the good news. The bad news, though, is that there is a sense, and I think you saw this in the media reaction to the shooting initially, where you could see, I think, a real anxiety, even as it quickly became clear that, you know, whatever else this guy was, he was somebody who was influenced by some kind of Islamist ideology, a real unwillingness to just come out and say that, and a real fear about, you know, and obviously you don't want the media to rush to judgment, you know, these are sensitive issues and so on, but the first few days of media coverage, I think, gave you a good clue as to why the Army spends so much time worrying about being perceived as anti-Islamic in any way.
Karen, what do you think?
Well, I think that, like I said, these are all going to be questions that are going to be looked at, and I hope will be looked at in congressional hearings and elsewhere. The other remaining question that we still don't have a definitive answer to is whether he acted alone or whether he acted in coordination with other people. And that, I think, is at this point, you know, there's no evidence that there was anyone else involved. But again, it's interesting that the authorities are not definitively ruling that out.
You know, President Obama was inaugurated, what, 10 months ago? But I really feel like in the last 2 weeks, he's assumed the role of commander-in-chief in a fuller way than we've seen before. He went to Dover to greet dead soldiers who were being returned, whose bodies were being returned. He went to Fort Hood to eulogize those who were killed in the shooting. He marked Veterans Day this week. He's weighing a decision on deploying more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. You really get the sense of a new phase, perhaps, of his presidency, Ruth.
And I think weighing is the right verb to use. The weight of the seriousness of the job, not that he didn't understand the seriousness of it, the momentousness of the decisions confronting him, particularly in Afghanistan, the human consequences of that decision, in addition to the geopolitical consequences of that decision, clearly are weighing on the president. And while he's been accused of dithering, he is also seriously trying in a very, I'm told, and I know this is maybe a subject for the next hour, but in a very rigorous and thoughtful way, trying to reason his way to the least bad answer in Afghanistan.
We'll talk more about the Afghanistan decision in the second hour of our news roundup when we have a more international focus. Let's talk about the health care vote. I wonder how many of us spent Saturday night watching CFIN. I have to admit, I was one of them. Ruth, I know you wrote about being one of them. How about you, Karen? Is that where you were?
Oh, I was at my mother's 80th birthday party, but I was able to catch up the next day.
How about you, Ross? Were you watching C-SPAN Saturday night?
I wasn't. Is it bad to admit that? Should
no,
I pretend that I was? But then
you
quiz, if you quiz me, what was I doing on Saturday night? I was undoubtedly following it through, you know, using my BlackBerry in some sort of horribly addictive way.
Not only was I watching it, but my husband and I were at a hotel that didn't have C-SPAN, so we huddled around my laptop and watched a live stream of the House debate. I am somewhat embarrassed to admit that, and I hope my children aren't listening. So, Karen, tell us, what mattered about this vote that we saw in the House on Saturday?
Well, I honestly believe that with this vote has come now a true sense of inevitability that this thing is actually going to get done. And it was interesting to see Bill Clinton brought over. First of all, as hard as it was and as close as it was in the House, a 5-vote margin, it is going to be exponentially more difficult to get this thing through the Senate because of its rules, because of its politics, 100 reasons. So it was interesting that the person they brought up to Capitol Hill on Tuesday to talk to the senators was none other than William Jefferson Clinton, who I wrote about this week in the magazine as the ghost of 1994. He was there to remind them what happened the last time they tried this and fell short. And it not only did damage to a young presidency, but it cost the Democrats the House and the Senate in the next election. I think that message, you know, the President Clinton's message, this doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to get done, is now settling in.
So his message is, whatever pain it will cause you to pass a bill, the pain will be worse if you fail to do so.
By the way, political pain and substantive pain, because the other thing that has happened in the last 15 years is the healthcare system is costing a lot more and covering a lot fewer people.
Ruth?
Well, I agree with what Karen said. I've always kind of reasoned back from the fact that the president has so lashed himself to the railroad tracks on getting health care passed that the one thing, which probably two things that we know. One is that in the end, his party will have to save him from the train of not getting it passed, bearing down on him. And he and his advisors will have to give up as much as they have to get something done. I think the second thing we know is that there are going to be a lot of perils of Pauline moments until then. There will be moments at which it will look like this whole thing is falling apart. And I think my message would be everybody should sort of settle down, because in the end, the message that President Clinton was sending is probably the right political analysis. They need to get something done because the alternative will be even worse for them.
Well, let me play devil's advocate then for a minute. I mean, I generally agree, and my assumption all along has been that the Democrats will pass something precisely because they're fixated on the idea of that they lost in 1994 because they didn't pass health care, which is plausible, though itself debatable. There were a lot of other factors in play in 94. I think, though, the fear for the Democrats has to be, I actually think it's still more a fear in the House than in the Senate. I think the Senate will ultimately pass something that will look like whatever Olympia Snow wants it to look like, let's say, hypothetically. But then, you know, whatever comes out of reconciliation will have to go back to both houses for a vote, and we'll see how long that takes. Maybe it'll happen before Christmas, as Harry Reid says. Maybe it drags into next year. And it's quite possible that you're going to have a number of Democrats who voted yes right now in the House looking for excuses to vote no. And they'll be looking for excuses because they'll be looking at polls. And the polls will probably continue to show that health care is, in, you know, depending on how you ask the questions, more unpopular than popular. And they'll probably continue to show Republicans with an edge in the generic congressional ballot, which is what they had in the Gallup poll this week, and it's something the Republicans almost never have because they have such among registered voters, not likely voters. And the times when they've had that before have been 1994 and 2002, both very bad years for Democrats.
Not quite a party line vote in the House. I guess, 39 Democrats voted with the Republicans, and one Republican crossed over. Who was it, Karen?
It was Congressman Joseph Gow. We all learned how to pronounce his name, among other things, this week. He is a really interesting congressman. He is a Vietnamese immigrant who represents a very heavily Democratic district. He's a Republican who represents a heavily Democratic district in New Orleans, and basically won only because the the incumbent, William Jefferson, was found with tens of thousands of dollars in his freezer.
It happens.
Right.
We've all been there.
So he is the single most endangered Republican on the ballot, I think, in the House races this year. But he also had made it pretty clear that he was looking for a reason to get to yes on this vote, and the one reservation he had was abortion. And they satisfied him on that. They also threw a lot of goodies his district's way as well. So I think it was a really interesting vote because it was a man who had set out some principles. And when the bill came in and lived up to those principles, he did what he said he was going to do.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go to calls in a few minutes. Ruth, you said there are going to be some perils of Pauline moments as we look ahead to the final phase of this healthcare debate. One of them seems to be over the issue of abortion. What is the debate that's going on now in Congress about that?
Well, the question about abortion is how to essentially maintain the status quo. So the status quo is that we don't use federal funds for abortion except in the cases of rape, incest, or where the life of the mother is endangered. And it becomes very difficult to, when you have a system that is A, administered by the federal government, and B, a big chunk of it in these new exchanges that will be set up, many of the enrollees in the exchanges, but in fact the overwhelming majority, will receive some degree of federal subsidy. How do you maintain that status quo? And so one answer has been, and this was the supposed compromise that the pro-choice groups used, to figure out a way to segregate the funds so that federal funds are not used for that part of the money that's used to do that part of healthcare, in other words, to perform abortions. And this is a solution that's used, for example, in how to handle federal family planning funds. But the argument on the other side has been, yes, but money is fungible. And so what we saw in the end was that what was called the CAPS Amendment did not go far enough to satisfy satisfy the Catholic bishops, who were very influential here, and to satisfy that group of anti-abortion Democrats, among others. And so they went further with an amendment from Congressman Bart Stupak from Michigan, a Democrat, which essentially will mean that none of the insurance plans within the exchange will be permitted to allow abortion coverage.
You know, Karen, I was surprised, I guess, that the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, was willing to go along with this amendment, which goes further than the Hyde Amendment does in restricting access to abortion. Why did she do that?
She did it because she needed to win. And she was even with that, she was only able to win with a 5-vote majority. Now, the politics, I think, get a little more complicated in the Senate. Already we've seen Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska saying that he wants language exactly like the House bill's language in the bill, or he won't vote for it. But the senators are in many ways more closely aligned, I think, with big national donors who are often lean liberal and are very, very upset about this. And so it's going to be this is an issue that was not on the radar screen in the Senate, even though it had been in the House. And I think this guarantees a pretty big fight on the Senate floor.
This is, I think, one of the issues that I was talking about before, where you could see if there are House Democrats and even a House Republican like the congressman from New Orleans looking for reasons to change their vote, if they think the political landscape looks too ugly when they have to vote again and they want a reason to change, this could be the issue. Because I agree with Karen, what comes back from the Senate and possibly what comes out of the conference is more likely to be closer to something like the CAPS amendment than the Stupak amendment.
Well, let's go to the phones and let our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Ryan, who's calling us from Asheville, North Carolina. Ryan, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I just want to say that I'm against the government takeover of health care. I think that any government that can give you anything you want is also powerful enough to take away anything that you have. But I think that if this thing passes, I think it would be more dangerous for the Democrats because they would actually have to defend a bill now. You know, up to this point, it's been, well, there are 5 different bills that have come out of committees, and there's always been that out that they've had. If something passes and they have to run on it, I think that might be the quickest path to a Republican House of Representatives, not necessarily the Senate. But it, I think, would be a very quick path to a takeover in 2010.
All right, Ryan, thanks for your call. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very interesting question, and it's one that the White House and Democrats have been thinking about for quite some time. Is, okay, so what happens when we wake up the day after health care passes? One of the things, one of the interesting parts of the bill is that most of it doesn't start to take effect until 2013. And so there's been some talk among administration officials is what deliverables they can produce. And then
such a great word.
And then the question is, well, will it work or not work?
Republicans will need to pick up 40 seats in the House to take control. That's a pretty high bar. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the economy, and we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Concerns about corruption complicate U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. And President Obama begins his first official trip to Asia. A panel of journalists on these stories and the rest of the week's top international news. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We've gotten a lot of emails from listeners about the question I posed earlier in this hour about was the shooting at Fort Hood an act of terrorism? I'm going to just read two of them. Andrea has sent us an email that says, to boil down an already boiled down analysis, the accused was assuredly a terrorist as he caused terror to those around him. And if one could imagine him involved with an organization, he could do great harm. So my question is, where does one draw the line between a psychotic acting criminally, which, mind you, always causes terror, and a psychotic involved in capital T terrorism? And here's another one from BJ, who writes us, among the most famous homegrown terrorists are the Olympic bomber, Timothy McVeigh, and the Unabomber. There were many others, and I don't think any of them were Muslims. Their actions were planned and executed with cold reason, and their victims were just as dead or wounded as the victims in Fort Hood. I wonder, Ruth, do you think it's useful to have a discussion about, was this an act of terrorism?
With a capital T or not capitalized? I don't actually think it's a very useful discussion. And if anything, there's a sort of continuum of terror to sort of get the capital even bigger. You know, at the extreme is the kind of terrorism that we experienced tragically on 9/11, which was really an organized conspiracy. And I guess at the other end is some lunatic who is acting for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do and are no way influenced by politics or religion, like, say, somebody going postal. And I think from what we know right now, the Fort Hood shootings were somewhere in the middle of that. He was he was clearly crazy, as anybody has to be, to commit an atrocity like that. And he was also, as Ross said, clearly influenced by a strand of Islamist ideology and belief in jihad and the wrongness of having Muslim U.S. military fighting other Muslims. So is that terrorism or not terrorism? That doesn't seem to me to be a sort of very useful argument having.
But I do think that that is why it is so important for us to find out things that we don't know about this. You know, whether he was acting in concert with other people, what were the influences on him? Because if there were those influences and those connections, that might suggest that, you know, this war against Al-Qaeda, which has sort of decimated its command and control structure, might have produced a new sort of, you know, entrepreneurial kind of terrorism that, in fact, could be, you know, the wave of the future. And that is why we need to get away from, you know, just sort of putting labels on things and really looking at what is driving this and whether this situation is transferable to other situations.
Well, right. And that's, I think, why, though, people, I mean, I think people seek the label as a way of delineating how politically motivated was this. And I completely agree there's a continuum. And so, you know, Major Hassan is more of a terrorist than John Muhammad, the you know, D.C. sniper, who is more of a terrorist than, say, the Virginia Tech shooter and so on. As the political motivation becomes clearer, I think the legitimacy of calling it terrorism becomes clearer as well.
But I think in a sense that Karen's question has already been answered. It's clear that there is a new class of entrepreneurial, I think I'll now give in and call them terrorists. And some of them are, you know, think of them as small business terrorists that have banded together. And some of them may be, you know, single solo entrepreneurs who are acting alone. It doesn't necessarily change the way you analyze what you need to do to combat it.
Well, it would certainly, though, change the way you figure out how you see this coming.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Michael. He's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Michael, thanks for holding on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you. It's discouraging to hear this conversation about the healthcare thing and how certain congressmen have to be bribed to vote for this. And, it, you know, you guys...
Oh, the bribe guy was the other guy, the previous guy.
No, but he
I'm
means...
I'm sorry.
He means...
No, I know. I was making a little Jefferson joke.
But I do think that, I mean, these guys get elected because they are expected to bring things home to their districts.
Yeah. Michael, did you want to pose your question again?
Yeah, please. Thank you. The point is that this healthcare thing, you know, people, you guys in Washington always focus on the horse race and is something getting done. And what we care about out here is it going to be good? Is it going to do what it says it's going to do? Are our politicians leveling with us? And this thing is full of lies on both sides. But the people with the power right now are the Democrats. They're lying about it. It's going to cost way more. Everybody knows that. You know, and it's just, you know, okay, so we have to give pork barrel stuff to twist the arms of a few Democrats to vote for this. And everybody screams about bipartisanship. The only bipartisan position on health care right now is in opposition to it. Look at the vote. You had one Republican voting for it, but you had 39 or so, or 40, I forget what it is, but it's a good number of Democrats voting against it. And yet, people in Washington complain about how unbipartisan the Republicans are. Well, it's all ridiculous. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. But all you guys care about is this good for the Democrats? Is this good for Republicans? And meanwhile, this is a Rube Goldberg, you know, ridiculous health care thing that's coming out. And President Clinton cares, well, just get something passed so we can say we did something. Well, what on earth good is that, just to say we did something? I mean, if it's something terrible, are they going to be proud about it? the fact that it doesn't kick in until 2015 after everybody's gone ought to show you that they don't care about this stuff. All they care about is acting like they care about people out here when they don't, and they're lying. And I just wish there was some honest analysis in Washington except about who cares about it. I know you're going to come back with things that say, well, there are facts published, but if you... most of the time is spent on horse race type stuff, and I think everybody knows that.
All right, Michael, thanks for your call. You know, I would say that the Diane Rehm Show in particular has done a lot of shows that talk about the substance of the proposals in the health care, in the various versions of the health care bill and health care overhaul. But it is true on the Friday News Roundup when we're talking about votes coming up in Congress, we do focus on the horse race because that is what's happening right now, especially as we get to this kind of final spurt of actually passing legislation. But Karen, I wonder if you want to respond to what Michael had to say.
Well, first of all, I think that it's becoming clear that there are some things in this bill that help an awful lot of people, including a lot of people who do not have health coverage right now. This bill does a number of things. It gets rid of exclusions that insurance companies now have where you can't get coverage if you're sick, which is, of course, when you need coverage. But the real genuine criticism of this bill is that it doesn't do enough about bringing down health care costs, which was the other reason that we embarked on this whole exercise. And I think that is where Michael has his doubts, and I think they're legitimate doubts.
Do you think that by the end of the year, President Obama will be signing a health care overhaul of some sort? Ruth, what do you think?
I think not by the end of the year, but by the end of January, I think he will. And I think that Mike raises some legitimate points. I guess one answer to that would be compared to what? Can we go on with, first of all, this number of Americans uninsured, second of all, health care costs rising so quickly, and third of all, the incredible drain on our budget, which goes to the point that Karen, among the most substantive of reporters covering the health care debate, raised. And I think that there are totally legitimate concerns about whether the projections that CBO has made, whether its models are accurate, whether legislators will really be willing to stick to the cuts in the future that they're legislating now. But I also think we need to keep in mind from my point of view, moral responsibility we have to help people get affordable health care and keep affordable health care. And second of all, the moral responsibility we have to get our fiscal picture under control.
Right. But I mean, the question, I think the way you laid it out just now with those three goals, I think the big question with the bill is how many of those three goals does it accomplish? And I think it's clear that you are going to get a large number of people who can't get insurance through this bill. The question is, what does it do for costs for individuals who already have insurance? What does it do to premiums? And what does it do to long-term fiscal picture? And it's those second two where I think there are completely reasonable doubts. I mean, the problem, the situation with any legislation is that it's going to be partially a Rube Goldberg contraption, as the caller said, and partially an effective piece of legislation. That's true of anything you pass. The question is, where is the balance? How much Rube Goldberg are you willing to put up with to get that extra, 10, 15, 25 million people into the insurance market? And
do you think there will be a bill passed and signed?
I think there'll be a bill passed and signed. I agree that I don't think it'll happen until early next year. But I think the Democrats, back to the horse race, I think they're wedded to the idea that they need to pass this bill or else they will go the way of the Democrats in 1994.
Do you think they're wrong in that calculation?
I think that they may well be wrong. I think that if you look at the upcoming election, at least the way it's shaping up right now, it's going to be an election about the economy and jobs, actually, more than an election about health care. And I think that actually the way the campaign plays out will have much more to do with the unemployment rate than whatever gets passed right now in healthcare, in part, as people said, because the actual bill doesn't start kicking in for a while.
But that is why they want to get this done in January, and specifically they want to get it done before the State of the Union speech. That way, I think it would be damaging for the Democrats to not get this done, because then people will say, wait, we elected you guys to get, you know, to get things done, and you are incapable of doing it. But if they can get it done by January, then Obama can sort of hit a reset button on his presidency and start focusing on things like jobs and the economy more than he has been able to with this.
Well, in fact, as President Obama was leaving town to go on his first official trip to Asia for 9 days, he stopped and made an announcement that he's going to convene a job summit, reflecting just what you were saying, right, Ross, that they're very concerned about this unemployment rate, which has now gotten over 10%. Ruth, what can a job summit do?
Bring peace between the Soviet Union and...
I hear the word summit applied to anything, I think with the exception of arms control, I just roll my eyes, because the answer is nothing. The administration has understood since before it became the administration that unemployment was a lagging indicator, that even as the recovery, the green shoots of the recovery were really growing, that unemployment was going to continue to rise, that it's going to continue to rise until next year. 10.2 was a very big shock last week because of the magnitude of the jump and the earliness with which it arrived. But what they could do is, in some sense, what they've already done, the stimulus, getting the stimulus spending out in an effective way. And I just laugh when I hear about the job summit.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, jobs are a concern, also the deficit. We got some pretty distressing news on the deficit yesterday, Ross. What did we hear?
We heard that it was extremely large.
$176 billion.
Right, which is the largest in...
It's the biggest proportion since 1945.
Since World War II,
it's the biggest proportion of our gross domestic product. And it is bigger than analysts expected beforehand. Do we know, Karen, why has it exceeded expectations, even some of the dire predictions about how big it would be?
Well, I think it's because, gross receipts are down and spending is up. And
that'll do it.
And it's, you see this, though, reflected not just on the federal level, but that the number of states that are just in really critical condition fiscally. And so as a result, you're hearing, for instance, some talk now of possibly using the leftover money in the TARP program, $200 billion that's available, to turn that to deficit reduction. This is now, I think, a big enough at 10% of GDP, it is a big enough issue and a big enough potential drag on the economy that it is threatening the recovery.
You think the deficit itself is threatening? Because there's also the argument that you need to be willing to run up a pretty big deficit when you're trying to get the economy going again.
Right. I think that the deficit is alarming, but I worry more about the long-term deficit than I do about this year's or next year's. And I think the White House has been very clear that something needs to be done. They are scrambling to figure out what deficit reduction measures to put into place or to at least propose in the budget that will be coming out in February. And at the same time, as you suggested, you don't want to make the mistake, actually, of 1937 and turn off the spending, which means start worrying about the deficit too soon. So it's a very, very dicey situation. I've become completely convinced that the only way for the political system to manage to handle this is through a commission, because I think if there's one thing that the last several months of conversation about healthcare reform and other things have shown us, it's that the existing system does a very good job of spending money. It does a much worse job of trying to save money.
Ross, the Charleston County Republican Party in South Carolina voted on Monday to censure their senator, Lindsey Graham, for not upholding the Republican platform. And what they complained about was that he was working with Democrats on an energy bill. Is he in trouble?
I doubt it. And I think I doubt it in part, and here we're getting back to the political horse race issues, but in part because I think that the bill he's working with Democrats on, some kind of cap and trade bill to deal with climate change, is probably not going to happen in the next year.
So he's not in trouble because
the issue is not going to be, if he were working with Democrats on healthcare, I think he'd be in a lot more trouble. But that issue, precisely because cap and trade is easily attacked by Republicans, and I think somewhat justly, as a job-killing or job-reducing measure. It's not something the Democrats are going to want to push in the next year. It's not going to do the work of a job summit.
I love the fact, too, that they accuse this senator who has a 90% lifetime conservative voting record of weakening the Republican brand, which you do have to ask compared to what.
It does tell you something about the mood of the GOP, which is pretty feisty. I mean, you saw that reflected also in that special New York congressional election that we had.
Well, I mean, the question is, what does the Republican Party want to be? Does it want to be a sort of pristine band of true believers, or does it want to be a bigger tent that could accommodate more people? I mean, let's remember that the last Republican nominee for president was a very big believer in cap and trade. So that this is anathema to Republicans is kind of ridiculous.
Ruth Marcus, Ross Douthat, and Karen Tumulty, thank you so much for being with me this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks a lot,
Susan. Thanks
so
much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.